going to be talking today about our work on an architecture for low latency communication in the data center. This is joint work with Abdul Kubani, who's now at Google, Tom Atso, who's formerly with Cisco, of course my advisor at Stanford, Balaji Prabhakar, and Amin Vahdat from UCSD and Google, and Masato Yasuda from NEC Japan. So the goal of this work is really to go after the latency of a data center fabric. And our motivation is that basically latency is really becoming a primary metric now for evaluating the performance of data center networks. And this really started several years ago with somewhat niche applications like high frequency trading and high performance computing. But in recent years, we're seeing that even for more mainstream large scale web applications like search or social networking sites like Facebook, latency, the operators care a lot about latency, and latency is really important. And this has given rise to work on new platforms like RAM clouds, which are basically storage systems where the data of an application is stored entirely in DRAM as opposed to disk. And in principle, this is, should allow very low latency access to the data. Now, from the network's perspective, all of these applications basically require the network to deliver, to basically give predictable low latency delivery for individual packets. For example, in RAM cloud, one of the targets is to allow for 5 to 10 microsecond RPCs end to end for sort of small objects across the fabric. And as I'll explain, this is very hard to achieve with today's networks. But first, I'd like to talk a little bit about why this actually matters. Why do we care about 5 or 10 microseconds of latency, and why that might be important to some applications? And I think the clearest example that I could give is the one that I've actually seen John Osterhout use a number of times for explaining why large-scale web applications should move their data to RAM clouds. And basically, the idea is to compare how a traditional application in today's sort of pre-the days of the web works compared to what we do today. So if you look at the way we would deploy an application before the web, you'd take a machine, you'd load the binary of the application into the main memory of the machine, and you'd also load all the data for that application into the main memory. And what's great is that the application would have very low latency access to its data. So it could do very complex sort of data intensive operations and algorithms like say graph traversals or things like that on its data very easily. Of course, this, we need to scale this now because we're dealing with much larger volumes. So what we do today is we take a bunch of racks, you know, lots of machines. We distribute our application across these. This becomes our application tier. We distribute our data on another set of racks, and these become our this becomes our data tier or storage tier. And now the application has to go across the data center network to get at its data. So say if this is Facebook, and I'm trying to load someone's Facebook page, I have to make a bunch of internal requests to from the application to my data tier, fetch all this data, and then I can load my page. So the problem here is, if you look at the numbers, the latency of the application to its data has increased by 4 or 5 orders of magnitude compared to when there was a single machine. So if you think about this and ask sort of how many small reads per second, like 100 bytes, for example, can I do, that single machine will probably beat 1,000 machines in this new model. So this fundamentally limits what actually these web applications can do. So if you take Facebook, you can do maybe 100, 150 internal requests per each page. So you can't get a sort of, you know, those complex data-intensive algorithms to work anymore. Another thing to note is that for one page, I may now want to do 100 or 1,000 of these internal sort of RPCs. So not only does the latency matter sort of on average, the latency at the tail is also very important. So even if one of that sort of 1,000 things takes a long time, the whole application suffers. And to really attack this, we need to go after latency everywhere. So now there's actually increasingly a lot of work both in industry and academia on reducing latency in software and hardware. So at the end host, for example, there's all these mechanisms like kernel bypass, zero copy, or RDMA-enabled NICs. And the RAM Cloud project has shown that you can take the software processing that's needed to build sort of an RPC system and reduce the processing down to about a microsecond. There's also a lot of low latency switching hardware coming out, which can forward packets in hundreds of nanoseconds. So really, if you look at the numbers, even across a large fabric, a fabric latency, sort of a baseline latency of 10 microseconds end to end should be achievable. But there's also queuing delay on top of this, which is sort of this random traffic-dependent delays that we're going to have in the network. And today, queuing delays can easily reach hundreds of microseconds or even milliseconds. So just to get a sense of numbers, a single 1,500-byte packet at 1 gigabit per second speed will give you 12 microseconds of queuing delay. So if I have 10 or, say, 100 of these queued somewhere, 100 will give me 1.2 milliseconds of delay right there. And it's with switches today, it's really easy to have 100 packets queued. It's no big deal. It can always happen. So the goal of this work that I'm just going to describe is really to try to reduce the queuing delays to zero. That's our focus. But at the same time, we also want to make sure that we use the bandwidth, we get good utilization of the data center fabric bandwidth. And that's because we look at these environments, and a lot of them, you have sort of mixes of traffic. You have a lot of latency-sensitive sort of mice flows, but you also have bandwidth-limited and throughput-intensive elephant traffic. And you want to do well for both, so you really want to get your baseline fabric latency, but you also want really high throughput. And the reason that's hard to do today is the way packet switch networks have always worked is that we kind of need buffering for good throughput in a way. I mean, the buffering is used as a way to create some slack, both when there's like an oversubscription and you want to buffer packets to avoid drops, and also when there's potential sort of rate fluctuations, like TCP is trying to figure out what the path bandwidth is, and while it's doing that, there may be these periods where there's rate fluctuations. The buffering helps us absorb those rate fluctuations. So, for example, a classical example of this is the bandwidth delay product rule of thumb for TCP, which says a single TCP flow needs a bandwidth delay product worth of buffering to get 100% throughput. And this comes from those variations. So the idea is that if I have a bandwidth delay product worth of buffering, like here, then when a packet is dropped or marked and the source is slowed down, there's a backlog there that will keep the link utilization high while TCP recovers. If I don't have that, then there's these periods where there is no backlog, and I could lose throughput. So at the high level, our approach consists of these three components. The key component is this idea of a phantom queue. What a phantom queue is just a way for the network to signal congestion before any actual queuing occurs. So as opposed to most queue management schemes, which signal congestion once a queue builds up, here we're going to signal congestion based on the utilization of a link before it reaches saturation. Secondly, we're going to use DCTCP congestion control. So DCTCP is this recently proposed congestion control protocol, which is an enhancement of TCP. And I'll explain it in a second, but basically the reason we use that here is we're going to be operating in a bufferless fashion, essentially. We have no slack, so we want low variation in rates, and that's what DCTCP gives you. It allows you to mitigate the sort of throughput penalties that can exist because you're operating in a bufferless fashion. And finally, we have these hardware pacers that work at the edge of the network and smoothen out the bursts that enter the fabric, which, as I'll show, can cause a lot of latency. And again, I want to stress that the main thing is this idea of running the links at below saturation. The other things are really consequences of trying to make that work, and I'll explain how. So just as a review, what the DCTCP algorithm does is it uses something called ECN, or explicit congestion notification. This is just a way for a switch to set a bit in a packet when it wants to signal to the sources that there's congestion. So the way we use it in DCTCP is really simple. There's a single threshold K. Think of K as maybe 20 packets. When packets arrive at the switch, if the occupancy of the buffer is larger than K, we set the ECN bit. We mark the packet. If it's below K, we don't mark the packet. So we get this one-bit feedback. And what the source does is it looks at that one-bit feedback, and it tries to infer from it how much congestion there is. So it's maybe easiest to explain through an example. Imagine a source receives these two sequences of ECN marks. So in one case, out of the 10 acts that it gets, 8 are marked, and in the other, out of the 10, only one is marked. TCP looks at a mark as if it's a packet drop, and it always does the same thing. When it wants to slow down, it cuts its rate or window size by a factor of 2. DCTCP reacts in proportion to the fraction of its packets that are getting marked. So here, it's going to infer that there's a lot of congestion. I'm going to cut by a lot. Here, there's probably not that much congestion, so it's going to cut by a small amount. The benefit of that is that you get this much more fine-grained rate adaptation with much lower variations. And because of that, you can now be very aggressive with congestion signaling. So this is just from an experiment in the original DCTCP paper. It's an experiment simple like this, where you just start a couple long-lived flows to a destination, so there's going to be congestion at that port. And here we're showing the queue occupancy inside the switch there. So with TCP, this is just drop tail, so you sort of build the buffer up to about 600 kilobytes, then you drop a packet, and you see this sort of sawtooth happening. With DCTCP, you set the marking threshold somewhere here at around 30 kilobytes, and the buffer sort of hovers right around that 30 kilobyte mark. Now here, we're getting full throughput for both, but we're just able to control the queues at a much lower level. But what we really want is we want to drive that queuing delay to zero. So if you look at the delays that we have, with TCP, you can have milliseconds. With DCTCP, you can do queue management and push those queues down, so you can drive it to maybe 100 microsecond level. That's the kind of numbers that you end up with. But if I want to really get it to zero, I can't rely on something like this. And the problem is that by the time I start signaling congestion, a queue has already built up. And it's on its way to increasing. So there's always going to be some baseline level of queuing that remains with something like this. And as I'll show, particularly at the tail, this becomes really important. So we need a new idea. And that idea is this idea of a phantom queue, which is drawn from the original work on virtual queue management that first was done by Gibbons and Kelly in 99, and then later enhanced by Kunir and Sirikant in 2001. And the idea is to have a simulated queue, this virtual queue, that sits in parallel with the physical queue. It sees the same input traffic, but it drains slower than what the physical queue drains at. So here, the link is draining at some speed C. This guy we're going to drain at some gamma times C, where gamma is less than 1. Think of gamma as maybe 0.9. So, and then we're going to set the ECM bit off of the occupancy of this virtual queue. So this should, in principle, allow us to control the utilization of the link at slightly less than its capacity and keep the physical queue from building up. Now, this is what we wanted to do. It's really hard to actually like take this and try something like this in the lab, because this doesn't really exist in switches, and what are you going to do? So an observation is you don't even need this to be inside the queue. I mean, we can do it outside in series in here what I'm calling a bump on a wire. So I can put this thing there, and for us, this is a FPGA. It's a module that we've implemented in FPGA. We just count basically things that arrive and decrement at this rate. We simulate this, and then based on the occupancy, we can set the ECM bit. And that's what a phantom queue is. So here's the first experiment that we did once we had this. So now I've added this blob there. That's the phantom queue. And what I'm doing is I'm sweeping the drain rate of that phantom queue. I'm going from about 600 megabits per second all the way to 980. This is on a 1G link. And I'm showing you the switch latency and the throughput. Now, this kind of works. I mean, it is the case that as I give up some bandwidth, by the way, the different lines here are just different marking thresholds on the phantom queue. As I give up some bandwidth, the latency does go down. Of course, I have a degradation in throughput as well. This isn't entirely satisfactory, though. I mean, what I would have hoped would happen is once I give up some bandwidth, let's say I have the phantom queue drain at like 900 megabits per second, I would have hoped that the latency would just plummet to zero, and then be at zero, right? But that's, you can see it's much more gradual than that. And I kind of have to give up a lot of bandwidth to really get to very low levels of latency. And the reason for this is that the traffic that TCP stacks generate is inherently very bursty. And it's particularly gets worse in data centers where you have all these optimizations that NICs have, like large send offload and interrupt coalescing. And at the high level, what these optimizations are all doing is they're batching up work. Interrupt coalescing, for instance, instead of the receiver receiving NIC sending every packet to the CPU immediately, it lets a bunch of them accumulate and then gives them to the CPU in one interrupt, in a batch. And this is really good, actually, it's crucial for the CPU utilization at high speeds, but it disrupts TCP's ACK clocking, so it makes traffic even more bursty than it would be. And these bursts then cause spikes in queuing, which increase latency. This is really easy to see in a lab. So this is just a very simple experiment. You just take two 10G servers, direct connect them, run a TCP flow, and we cap the window size of that TCP flow. So on average, this guy is sending at 1 gigabit per second. So it's a 1G flow on a 10G link. And here I'm showing you a trace of sequence numbers. So I would have liked to see this sort of linearly increasing slope. Instead, I see a stair type function. So what happens is about every half a millisecond, I get a 65 KB burst at line rate. At 10G, and then for half a millisecond, there's nothing happening, and then this just repeats. So you can see the bursting is happening. So to deal with this, We also implement a hardware pacing module. Again, this is an FPGA module for us. You can think of it as eventually being absorbed into a NIC. And it's just a token bucket rate limiter. You put in the traffic that comes out of the server, that's bursty, you pace the traffic going out. And there's just two algorithmic challenges that you have to deal with. One is, at what rate should I pace? So we do that dynamically. Basically, the idea is that the higher layer TCP or DCTCP or whatever it is, well, it's going to figure out the correct rate. We're just going to try to see what that is. So we have this simple control loop that measures the rate coming into the token bucket and tries to match the drain rate of the token bucket to be the same thing. And there's a term that tries to avoid the occupancy of that queue becoming too large as well. A second important thing is, which flows should I pace? So by definition, this pacer is going to add some delay. It's queuing packets. So I don't want to pace the small sort of latency-sensitive traffic. That will just defeat the whole purpose of everything I'm doing. So what you want is, you kind of want to pace the large flows, the elephants, which are not sensitive to individual packet delivery times. The way we try to do that kind of automatically here is, on every acknowledgment that I get, if there's an ECN bit set with some probability, like 1 over 16, I'm going to assign that flow to the pacer function. So basically, there's a flow association table. Now, the point of this is that, basically, you have to meet two conditions to get paced. First of all, you have to be causing congestion somewhere, so you're getting some ECN bits. Secondly, you have to be long enough to get sampled by this probabilistic thing. So a lot of the mice are just going to get filtered because of that. So just to quickly repeat that previous example, so now note that there are these blobs, and these are the pacers. So now you see that it kind of works like what you would hope. I mean, once I get to this about this 900, 950, I hit this floor value of 5 microseconds for my latency, and it's just flat beyond that. And note that the throughput is also just linearly decreasing with the drain rate, as you would hope, and the marking threshold doesn't really matter, because we're signaling based on rate now, not any occupancy. And just to show you a comparison, so this is what you saw before, and this is what you have now. At the mean, at the 99th percentile, it's maybe even more clear that it's very hard to get that 99th percentile down without pacing. With pacing, I can hit this 21 microsecond floor value. So to put it all together, this is what we're calling the Hall architecture. We have these phantom queues. They sit on the links. They make sure the no link sort of runs at saturation, and hopefully we can have this early warning system, which lets it throttle before any queues build up. We have hardware pacing at the edge. It smoothens the traffic coming into the network. And we have DCTCP congestion control running inside the stacks here. The important thing, it's not really crucial that this is DCTCP or anything. The only thing that's important is, because we don't have any buffering in the network, you want this to be very stable rate control. And that's really just the reason we use DCTCP. You could use anything else. So just a few words about our implementation and our evaluation. So basically, as I explained, we've implemented this phantom queue pacer modules in hardware, in FPGA. We have also implemented a latency measurement module. It's this guy there. The reason for this is, so we're trying to track microsecond level latency. And one of the things we found is, you can't really do this if you're going to try to like ping from the stack or something like that. So what we do is, we have this guy, it just timestamps packets when they're entered the switch and timestamps it when they come out, and it gives you a very accurate measurement of the latency going through the switch. We have also implemented DCTCP in Linux, the patch is online, and our evaluation really consisted of these two things. We had a small testbed at Stanford, this is 10 server testbed that you see here. So we ran a lot of micro benchmarks to sort of figure out what are the effect of the various parameters that exist, how does it work in sort of static or dynamic scenarios, how does this compare to having priorities, a bunch of different micro benchmarks. And then we did large-scale NS2 simulations as well to sort of see what happens with a multi-hop topology, sort of a bigger fat tree kind of thing. And I'm not going to have time to talk about most of that. I'll just give you one representative experiment that kind of is representative of what you see. So this is what we're calling this dynamic flow experiment. So it's like this. You have these 9 servers. 9 of them are acting as senders. There's one receiver. What the receiver does is, it just, according to some arrival process, some like Poisson arrival process, it's going to request files from a randomly chosen sender. The file can either be a large file or a small file, according to some distribution. So it's just, you know, trying to give you a mix of traffic. And what I'm showing you here, and by the way, the rate of these requests is chosen so that this link, this congested link, is going to run at some desired load. Like here, it's 20%. So on average, this receiver should be getting data at 200 megabits per second. And so what I'm showing here is both the latency across that congested port and the completion time of the large flows, which should give you a sense of what's the impact of giving up some bandwidth. So to start with TCP, you see that we can have very bad sort of latency. Even at this 20% load, at the 99th percentile, I could have a millisecond, 1.2 milliseconds of latency. With DCTCP, with sort of the standard recommended marking threshold of 30 kilobytes, well, you can definitely get like a 4x improvement. Again, at the tail, it's pretty bad. It's 300 microseconds. If I try to optimize this so I can push that marking threshold down, now, one of the things that we found is if you want to do that, you need to pace the traffic as well. So that's really where this requirement comes from. Like if you just bring the marking threshold down, what you see a lot of throughput loss. With the pacing, you can avoid that. And this is kind of like an optimized value where we could bring it down to about 6 kilobytes with pacing where we still got sort of full throughput. And you can see that I can again make another 5-6 X improvement. What's hard to control is really this tail. So this is not that high a load, but still at the tail I have 60 microseconds, and that's what becomes hard. If I give up some bandwidth now with a phantom queue that runs at say 950 megabits per second, I can see that, okay, now I can get to very low values. This 3 microseconds at the mean and 18 microseconds at the tail, just to put it into perspective, as I said, a single packet is 12 microseconds of delay. So this says that at the 99th percentile, there is 1.5 packets in the queue. So you're almost running these queues empty now at this point. Now correspondingly, there is an increase to the completion time of the 10 meg flows. So these guys are going to mainly be determined by the bandwidth that they can get, and you see an increase compared to the other guys. So overall, we can get, compared to DCTCP, about a 93% decrease in the latency for about a 17% increase in the completion time of the large flows. And this completion time, this increase, the slowdown for the elephants, how much it is, there's actually a model in the paper. You can do a simple sort of process sharing model that tells you what that number should be, and it matches very well with experiments. But I'll skip that in the interest of time. So in conclusion, I talked about this architecture that we're calling Hall. It combines phantom queues, DCTCP, and hardware pacing. And really the main idea here is to trade a resource that I would argue is relatively plentiful in modern data centers. So we're seeing bandwidth increasing in stages where we're going from 1 to 10, 40 is on the horizon, and then it's going to be 100 gigabits per second. But we're trading some of that for a metric that's actually really hard to control, which is latency. And we can get dramatic reductions in latency, often 10 to 40x lower latency compared to the standard TCP and even DCTCP. And with that, I'll conclude, and I'm happy to take your questions.
I'm John Dunnigan from Amazon. So I'm familiar with the use of RDMA, both in file systems and in HPC workloads. In both cases, to the best of my knowledge, it doesn't run over TCP because of the additional latency that's introduced at the end host by running over TCP. So my question for you is, how do those kinds of non-TCP traffic interact with running everything over DCTCP, as in the description you've given?
Yes, that's an excellent question.
Okay, let me give you the second question in case, because they're kind of related. Okay. It's also a question about software overhead at the end host. So my understanding of Facebook is that they do all of their programming in PHP. They're going to have some kind of marshalling and unmarshalling overhead between getting the data out of PHP, sending that request out to the server, and it coming back. And I really wonder how much that adds compared to the amount that you're reducing in the network. So similar questions about in-host software overhead.
Okay. So to get at the first question, that's absolutely correct. You know, most of these mechanisms, like RDMA mechanisms, actually all of them, I guess, right now they don't run on top of TCP. There's really, I think the main point I would see of this work is to explore this idea of underrunning links. The details of exactly what that congestion control is, like is it TCP, is it, you can do sort of a stable rate control on top of your own sort of UDP-based thing or something that runs on top of RDMA or even in hardware. So we did this because, well, it's the most easy thing for us to sort of experiment with running standard TCP, and we didn't have RDMA-enabled NICs anyway. And if I don't know if how many of you picked up on that, like I didn't even show the completion time of the 1 KB flows in my experiments because they're sort of lower bounded by so much more. It's like 300 microseconds. And that's because we didn't really have the ability to do these kinds of optimizations like RDMA. But I think in principle, you could take the same thing and you can apply it in that context as well. And on software processing, I think it's definitely a fair point to say that today's software is not optimized to still take advantage of this. But I think there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem here. There's not incentive yet maybe to do that because, well, you know, you have so many other bottlenecks. I think if things like RAM Cloud or things like this, you can show that it is feasible, I think we can go a long way to optimizing those overheads out as well.
All right, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Mark Handley. So from the experiments and data centers we've done with topologies like Factory and so forth, when you've got a reasonable load on a data center, when a new flow starts up, with pretty high probability it'll collide with an existing flow somewhere in your hierarchy that's already pretty much filling a pipe. And so when that happens, how long does it take your mechanisms to yield that reasonable amount of that capacity to the new flow? I mean, my understanding is because you're doing a lot of ECN marking and so forth, you'll kick out a slow start really early and then take a long time to yield. Is that my assumption's correct?
So you're absolutely right. You'll kick out a slow start early. But this flow that's starting is not the flow that's consuming the link. So the ECN marks will slow down the other guys and let this guy ramp up, right? Am I misunderstanding?
Well, if you're just doing random ECN type marks on a virtual queue, then he'll, with pretty high probability, the new flow will pretty high probability take an ECN mark early too. And yeah. Then he'll be in DC-TCP's very slow ramp up phase. Right. From a very low bandwidth to start with. So take a very long time to get up to a reasonable speed.
So your worry is, is it okay that we're sort of kicking out a slow start early?
What I'm concerned about is new flows that actually may, because there's an existing flow there, actually experience a very high completion time because they're competing with an existing flow that's already there and it doesn't yield quickly like you do with regular TCP.
I understand. So, okay. It's a matter of it's a question of convergence, I understand.
Yes.
So for DC-TCP, we have done an analysis of exactly this thing of, you have a flow that's sort of at sending at line rate, you have another flow that starts, how long does it take for those window sizes to converge, assuming just you don't even have slow start. And it turns out that is, you get a constant factor increase on top of TCP. Like if TCP takes 100 round trip times, you can take 40% more with DC-TCP. So there's a paper in Sigmatrix 2011 that does that analysis. The intuition is that it's true that you're, this guy is taking less cuts per each event, but events happen very rapidly now. And when you do the math there, you see that the convergence speed is, you get a constant factor. It's like 1.4x at most larger than TCP.
Okay. Hi, I'm J.K. Lee from HMLabs. Great work. So you know there is a previous work on TCP pacing, and you know or packet spacing in TCP algorithm itself, and also Linux QDIS can do some little bit of pacing. So the reason why you are using hardware pacer is because of the hardware, physical NIC offload, or is there any other reason?
That's exactly the reason. We looked at sort of software pacing. We actually did an early implementation. First in software, and there's also a number of tools available. I mean, there's a number of things that already exist. The problem is when you have these offloads like LSO, if you want to do pacing in software, you kind of have to disable that because LSO is going to give you these big frames to work with. And these frames are what's going to hit the NIC and then the NIC's going to burst them out. But one of the experiments that you can see this in the paper, at 10 gigabit per second speed, you can't get rid of these offloads. You need both LSO and interrupt coalescing, at least like on a fairly, I think it's a Nehalem processor that we have in our lab. We still can't achieve line rate unless we have that. So the nice thing about the hardware pacer is there's really two things. First of all, it's transparent to these offloads. It works on packets after segmentation has taken place. The second thing is that, well, you can potentially be a lot more accurate. Like, I can pace at a very fine granularity.
Hey, Kostin Raichu from University of Polytechnic Bucharest. So, I mean, this is probably a dumb question, but if I just have two priority queues and, you know, I mean, you see where I'm going, right? So
the
stack marks, this is a low delay flow, this is a high, you know.
Yeah. Yes, that's abstract. Why is that's
it
actually
not
an
enough?
Excellent question. It's,
I mean, it's, I think people are doing this already, right?
Yes and no. So that's actually an excellent question. So that is the sort of the first scheme that you would compare against this against. And we do that comparison in the paper. So at the high level, there's two difficulties with priorities that we found. First of all is application developers, they don't really want to think of network priorities when they're developing applications. So I don't think anyone's really done that successfully. What is typically done with priorities is that you assign an entire application to a priority. Like, I might say, all my RAM cloud traffic has a higher priority than whatever else, or all my search queries have a higher priority than whatever else. That could, and that is, I think, done today. But it's much harder to sort of say, dynamically, I'm going to figure out, okay, these flows are the ones that are sort of large and these are small. If that could be done, and if priorities are obeyed everywhere. So what I mean by that is when we experiment with priorities, and again, the details of this are in the paper, if you enable priorities in the network switches, you get benefit there. You can definitely see that the high priority queue has low latency. But still, in terms of sort of end-to-end, it doesn't look that good because the NIC itself can become congested as well. So the NICs also have to obey those priorities. Potentially, the software has to obey those priorities, but that I'm less sure about. But I think if you can get rid of those two hurdles, so obey priorities end-to-end and have a way of dynamically assigning priorities without having to get hints from applications, then I think that's a very feasible approach. And what we show in the paper is this gets you close to that. That would actually be almost an ideal scheme. But this is almost
Thanks.
As good.